Army mateys, and welcome back to Historical Friction, a podcast about retelling the past and reframing the present through pop culture and fiction. We're officially into pirate season here on the podcast, and in today's episode, Alice, Helen, Sarah, and I, Abigail, sit down to discuss the 1950 Walt Disney film Treasure Island. This film, based on Robert Louis Stevenson's adventure novel Treasure Island, which is set in 1765 but was first published serially in 1881 and 1882 in the children's magazine Young Folks, centers on young Jim Hawkins, morally upright Captain Smollett, and, most famously, the wily pirate Long John Silver. Today, we discuss some behind-the-scenes facts about the Disney film, the effect that Stevenson's novel had on cultural understandings of pirates, how this particular portrayal of Long John Silver influenced Hollywood pirates, disability representation in Treasure Island, and a brief history of navigation. Just a heads up, we do also briefly touch on the transatlantic slave trade in this episode. You can find our podcast on Twitter at History Friction, and if you like our podcast, please rate and review us, or just recommend us to a few friends. We also have a Patreon, where patrons receive monthly digests with sneak peeks of upcoming episodes and behind-the-scenes looks at what we're currently working on, watching, and reading. Shiver me timbers! We're always grateful for any support that you can give to the podcast. Thank you, and enjoy the episode!
Hi everyone, we've got all four of us here today. We are talking about Treasure Island. Specifically, we watched the 1950 film version, but we wanted to have a bit of a chat about the novel, its context, the kind of reference points within it, and use this as a bit of a kind of anchor point for our pirate season with all of the themes and discussions that come with this book and film. I'm Alice. I was going to try and come up with a zippy little pirate-themed joke to introduce myself, but I'm too tired for that.
I'm Abigail, and I was also trying to think of one, and the best I came up with was pieces of eight.
I'm Helen, and I'm still trying to get over the fact that Alice referred to this episode about pirates as an anchor point.
Oh, shit.
Nice. I'm Sarah, and yeah, I was too tired to even pick up on that.
Welcome to Historical Friction, Sleepy Edition. So, as I was saying, we watched Treasure Island. It's based on the novel by Robert Louis Stevenson, which I feel like is still such a kids lit classic. I don't know about everyone else. I had the audiobook of this and Kidnapped on cassette tape, and they were one of our classic like bedtime tapes when I was a kid.
Yeah, exact same kind of story. I think I had the collected works of Robert Louis Stevenson introduced to me by my grandmother, who absolutely loved them. My mum is named Katrina after a character from a Robert Louis Stevenson novel. So it's like a family tradition in our household. Warm, fuzzy memories coming up for me on this episode for sure.
Yeah, I read the abridged version as a child of this book. I've still never read the proper long one, but yeah, I read it a lot.
I never actually read this as a kid. It was always in my head as something that was out there in the world, but I had seen the Muppet version when it came into theaters in the 1996, I guess. So I always knew it just from the Muppets, and I finally listened to the audiobook of it like maybe 5 years ago as an adult, because I was like, maybe I should actually know what this is about. Plus, there is a chain fish restaurant in the United States called Long John Silver's that, like, it's like a ghost chain. Like, nobody eats there. There are memes about, like, how does Long John Silver stay afloat? Who eats there? And I will tell you, it is me. I eat there. My boyfriend and I once drove an hour away from our home just to get Long John Silver's fish at the nearest location that was still operating. So I feel like Long John Silver's is baked into my life.
I think we've found an answer about what Long John Silver went on to do after he escaped the Española.
So this film version massively streamlines the plot of the novel. There is a lot of mucking around in England before they even get going in the book. And I was grateful to the tidiness of this. There's no messing around with Jim Hawkins' parents. There's no kind of back and forth over, you know, the inn being like destroyed and things like that. It just very quickly zips along. But the book and the film opens with a character called Jim Hawkins, who's a kid. He is about 12 years old, usually, in most versions, and I think that's about how old he is in the book, who works at an inn where a man called Billy Bones is living. Billy Bones, turns out, was the first mate of the infamous pirate Captain Flint, and Bones has Flint's last treasure map. So the other members of Flint's crew want to find this map and find the buried treasure. Hijinks ensue is probably the simplest way of explaining this. A absolute fucking idiot called Squire Trelawney decides to launch an expedition once they find Bones' treasure map. And because he has absolutely no brain, accidentally hires a bunch of pirates to be the crew on his ship. So basically everyone who was on Flint's crew ends up as a deckhand or whatever on the Hispaniola. They get to the island. There's a lot of back and forth over sort of who has the rights to the treasure and things like that. But at the core, we have this sort of struggle for power between Captain Smollett, who is the smartest man in the entire book and film and everything, who is the captain of the Hispaniola that's been hired by Trelawney, and the mutiny led by Long John Silver.
Very succinctly put.
I'm trying so hard.
Something that I love about this whole story is that it absolutely falls into the trope of little orphan boy acquires multiple gay dads. Jim Hawkins, at the start of the 1950 film, appears to have sprung like Venus from the ocean. He has no parents, he has no accountability. He seems to be this beleaguered tiny adult in a child-sized body running an inn by himself. Because, as you say, they do away with all the drama about his sickly father and his mother who's determined to get her cash, and they just zero in on Jim himself. So the outcome of it is he has, like, wacky, goofy dad, Squire Trelawney, and sensible dad, Dr. Livesey, and authoritative captain dad, Captain Smollett, and cheeky, wild dad, John Silver. And they're all piling in to shape him into a man.
That was one of my notes on the 1950 film. I was like, is Jim running this pub by himself? Does he own this? What is going on? Because in the book, of course, they do talk about how he's there with his parents and his dad is alive at the start of the book and dies, like, you know, in the second chapter or something. And then his mom is around for a while. So he does have parent figures in the book. But no, this Disney film was just like Jim Hawkins, this 12-year-old boy runs this pub on his own, all by himself. He takes care of the drunk Billy Bones. He's doing it all.
And I would say that, like, the original novel is serialized in kind of a boys magazine when it's first published. It's very much kids literature. And Stevenson talks about it as being like for kids, for teenagers. And so the audience is supposed to be about Jim's age. It is such a classic motif in children's fiction to ditch the parents as quickly as possible. That's why you have so many orphan protagonists. That's why, like, boarding school is such a classic trope. But you've got to get your kids' parents out of the picture as fast as possible, because this is escapist fiction and you can't have an adventure with your mom around. So I thought it was so funny that, like, obviously in the book there's all this sort of, ooh, his parents are involved, kind of. But yeah, Disney's like, this child runs a pub. Move on.
Yeah, so this was Disney's first fully live-action film. Disney had dabbled in live-action before, but they had put animation with live-action in Three Caballeros. There's a section that has a live-action female dancer and then, like, Donald Duck's face coming out of flowers. It's really trippy. And he had been doing this sort of mix of live-action and animation since the 1920s when he had some Alice shorts based on Alice in Wonderland. But for this one, animation was very expensive and had really taken a hit during the 1940s. So in 1941, there was a big Disney studio strike where all of his animators went on strike against him, and it was a big deal. He felt very betrayed because he had just built this beautiful new studio with south-facing windows and air conditioning in the 40s in Los Angeles, but he wasn't raising anybody's salaries. So there was this big strike. There was a huge shakeup. A lot of Disney animators went to other studios. So now animation was more expensive to make just on basis of paying the animators. Then, of course, World War II happened. And that was a huge deal in the whole world. But Disney in particular got involved making propaganda shorts and propaganda films, which is actually what Three Caballeros and its other film, Saludos Amigos, are. The U.S. government paid him to do a good neighbor tour of South America and then to make films to try to keep South America from falling to communism was basically the idea. But the Saludos Amigos and Three Caballeros films didn't do great. He had a few other package features with animation that didn't do great. The animation studio was on its last legs, and they were putting Cinderella into production, which also came out in 1950. But he was like, I need other money. And so they were exploring ways of doing a live action film. And they had a bunch of what were called frozen funds in the UK. So it was prior box office receipts that they had not gotten from the UK. It was sort of like store credit because a post-war policy in the UK said that those funds could only be used for making a film in the UK. And RKO, who was Disney's distributor at the time, also from different features, had some frozen funds. So RKO and Disney went in together on Treasure Island and had to make it in the UK. So he shot on location, I believe in Cornwall, for the majority of the film. And this film cost $1.8 million to make, and it got a box office return of about $4.8, almost $5 million. So that's a huge return, and it also didn't take very long to make, whereas animation is much more expensive to make and takes for fucking ever. So live action was a lot less risky of a prospect for them. But he ended up making this, and he had Bobby Driscoll playing Jim Hawkins. And Bobby Driscoll was a Disney child star who ended up voicing Peter Pan in the 1953 animated film.
I was going to say, watching this, I was like, why does his face look so familiar? And then I realized it's because he's got the same kind of like pinched, like very upturned nose and like really deep forehead furrows of Peter Pan.
His face looks animated.
Yeah, as soon as you said that, it kind of slotted into place for me.
Yeah. So he plays Peter Pan later, but in this film, he was one of the only Americans on set. And I think you can kind of tell in his weird trying to be British, but mid-Atlantic 1950s accent.
Would we call that trying?
Okay, the kid was 12.
I particularly enjoyed how he elongated the syllables of his own name so that Jim had like two syllables. I'm Jim.
But he didn't actually have a permit to work in the UK. So Disney just shot his scenes anyway, even though like the UK government had been like, this kid is not allowed to be in your film, and took it to court. And Disney was like, well, we'll just film it while it's in court. And then once it came back and was like, no, you can't have this kid in your film, he was like, well, it's already been filmed. Which is really ballsy. And then Bobby Driscoll has a really sad story, actually. He ended up dying when he was 31 of a heroin overdose, and like had a lot of writings about how lonely he felt like in his 20s. He gave some interviews where he was like, I was being carried on a silver platter and then I was dumped in the trash and stuff like that. So it's real sad.
I don't know if it was like knowing the context of that story as I was watching him perform, but I think it definitely influenced the way I was reading him and his performance of Jim. Because looking at his face, as you said, Alice, he has the little upturned nose and the very sort of like cherubic rosebud mouth and these quizzical eyebrows. Like, he looks very angelic, but sometimes his facial expressions just somehow like morph into this really adult way of looking.
Yeah.
And because I knew like the background story of what happened to Bobby Driscoll, I was thinking quite frequently through this film, this is a studio child of the era. And there's like something adult about him that has made him grow up too fast. And in that way, actually, he kind of is like a really good casting for Jim, because Jim as a character is someone who has also been made to grow up too fast by the circumstances that he found himself in.
Mm.
Yeah. There's also Robert Newton, who plays Long John Silver. And Robert Newton was a British actor who had been born in Dorset and was educated in Cornwall. So the accent that he uses for Long John Silver,
oh my God,
is just this super exaggerated West Country accent that has become iconic and really shaped what the Hollywood pirate became. So in our episode on The Pirate, the 1948 film, Lisa Duffy, who was our guest on that episode, was talking about how even though there had been a few Treasure Island films prior to this, this one really became the seminal Treasure Island film, and Robert Newton's performance changed the Hollywood pirate ideal from being this swashbuckling, dashing Douglas Fairbanks romantic hero into being talk like a pirate day pirates, like going arr me matey and having like the parrot on the shoulder and saying shiver me timbers all the time and stuff like that. So I think it's interesting the effect that this film has had on our cultural conception of pirates as a whole.
Yeah, it's like that transition between the gentleman pirate and then kind of shifting it over to being something that is quite ironic, because you hear it in this extremely broad piratical language style.
Yeah, to the extent that when I moved to the UK and I heard like a West Country accent for the first time, I thought it sounded like a pirate accent.
Yeah.
it's such an exaggerated version, obviously, that Newton's using in this. And he's also got these completely like over the top facial expressions. He's like constantly winking and like twitching his teeth. And it's like actually kind of painful to watch his face sometimes. And it's really distracting. But I thought this was really interesting because this is very much not sexy. There is, and that's like, yeah, it's a kid's film. It's for children. It's based on a book for children. There is not a single female character in this film. But it's also really interesting to me that we have this history of swashbucklers, right? Like, obviously, our episode on The Pirate talked about that a lot. Sarah and I touched on this a bit in our episode on Beauvalet when we were putting it in the context of people like Errol Flynn and Douglas Fairbanks, who are the kind of like sexy gentleman pirates that then influence Georgette Heyer's version of the pirate in her historical novel. This is like the least sexy film. Everyone looks so sweaty and not in a kind of like sexy, grimy kind of way, in that everyone just looks like they've just been like sprayed with a spray bottle. I was stunned by just how sweaty everyone looked in this film.
In that way, it's quite an accurate portrayal of what it would be like to sail to the Caribbean wearing one of those ridiculous wigs.
Yeah, completely. It's worth mentioning as well that the action of the book and this film is very firmly placed in 1765. So we're very much in 18th century kind of age of piracy and the mythology that that occupies in people's imaginations. We've talked about this a little bit with the Beauvalet episode again, but this idea of the kind of like romantic privateer has a huge amount of cultural currency. Something I kept noticing was that everyone talks about how they served under the immortal hawk, Admiral Hawke, and this is how Long John Silver and his pirates con their way onto Trelawney's ship, is that they say they served under the Admiral. Admiral Hawke was a major figure in the Seven Years' War, which actually ran for 9 years, but ended in 1763. So it's like very much in the immediate context before the events of Treasure Island. And Hawke is a British naval officer who leads in the naval campaigns against the French and the kind of defense of British colonial interests in the Seven Years' War, which is fought between Britain and France, and it's mostly about control of territories in the Caribbean and the Americas and things like that. So this is very much a colonial context. Hawke is also, just as a side note, a big part in ensuring the funding and support for Captain James Cook's first voyage to the Pacific and the British colonization of the Pacific. So he is a huge figure in British colonial history. He's not normally the kind of big name that everyone recognizes, but he is like very much a power player in that history. And there's also a line in this about how Jim Hawkins has a good seafaring name. And then they go on to talk about Hawke. And the parallel, like Hawke and Hawkins, is obviously there. But my first thought was John Hawkins, which was the name of basically the first British slave trader. He was a privateer in the 16th century. He captures a Spanish slave trading vessel in the Caribbean and sells the captured people on board for a profit and comes back to England, brings this information to Elizabeth I, who then invests in the first deliberate British slave trading voyage. And this is the start of Britain being a power in the transatlantic slave trade. So that was my first association. That's the reference that I would have gone to. John Hawkins is an interesting kind of historical analogue for Jim Hawkins, because he's both a privateer and someone who's in the service of the British Crown, so he's got a foot in both camps. The original Hawkins was also Francis Drake's cousin. Drake is involved in this history too. So that was like my immediate pirate context for this, just as a bit of the historical background of what's going on in the 18th century, but also this kind of earlier history of British power in the Caribbean. And it's worth pointing out that although Treasure Island doesn't have like a specific location, it's strongly implied to be in the Caribbean.
Yeah. In Colin Woodard's book, The Republic of Pirates, I think he talks about how it's a Caribbean island that was called, I think, the Island of Pines.
Oh.
He says that it is the Island of Pines later served as the model for Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island. So it is now a part of Cuba.
Something that I was very intrigued by in this film was the sort of choice to make it an absurd notion that Silver actually served under Hawke.
Mm.
Because as I was re-listening to the audiobook, there's like a part in it where they're talking about, you know, it's terrible that he doesn't have a pension, and the piratical crew that are taken on are all former naval seamen who were not pensioned off, and so they have to make their way. And I, in reading the book, kind of took that at face value, because we do know that it was very common for people to take to piracy following an actual naval career, and maybe they had taken on an injury during their service, or they had been let go for disciplinary reasons. But because the seafaring way is a way of life, and because people were often, you know, in traumatic context, you know, fighting, battle, privateering, they absorbed a way of life that made it very hard to reconnect to regular civilian ways of life. So when we first meet John Silver, he's running an inn in Bristol, and he's sort of gone straight, so to say. And in the book, it kind of talks about his like characteristic in life and the fact that he has married a woman of colour. It says in the novel, mm-hmm. like he's married to a black woman, and Dr. Livesey and Squire Trelawney kind of do this slightly racist nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing of, well, I think we know why he's keen to get back to sea. But to me, all of those attributes kind of made Silver what I would associate as like a very likely candidate for someone who had been serving and been injured and not been pensioned off. And if you take that storyline at face value, it kind of turns him into a much more sympathetic character. Now, I understand why the film did this thing of sort of saying, like, as if you would have really served under Admiral Hawke, because it's in their interests to establish that he is a manipulator, and they don't have the time that the book devotes to showing all the little idiosyncrasies and contradictions within Silver's behaviour, which the novel establishes really well over a long span of time. So it serves them, for the purposes of the film narrative, to just straight up say, like, he's lying, by the way. But I did think it was kind of interesting as well, given the sort of 1950s ideology of the adaptation, to very explicitly say outright, these are the good naval seamen and these are the bad seamen, and we're going to draw a clear distinction between them. The reality is that there's a lot of overlap between those categories.
Plus, I feel like in the 1950s, you can't exactly have a lot of your major villains be veterans, right? Like, that's going to feel messy.
Yes, ideologically a problem for the year that film came out.
Yeah, but I also think that John Long Silver is, in the book and in this film particular, and not so much in other films that we'll talk about later, he's a really complex character, because he does seem like he really cares about the young protagonist, and we know because it is expressed in the film, it's not just something that's said. He is not just a villain, that also comes through in his personal relationships with Jim in this case.
Yeah, I was thinking I also re-listened to the audiobook and, you know, watched all the films that we watched. But I was thinking how Long John Silver is such a complex character, like Sarah was saying. And I think that is the only reason that this book has the longevity that it has had, because so many other boys' adventure stories just fall by the wayside. And this one has become a classic, I think, because Long John Silver, he's a villain, but he's not a villain, but he is a villain. And I think that's so difficult to deal with, which is something that I want to touch on when we do a later episode about Treasure Planet, what they do with the character of Long John Silver there. But I think that it's really interesting how he does horrible things. He kills people within the book. He kills Mr. Arrow, just like straight up. And we see that happen in this 1950 film, that he gets him drunk and pushes him out into a storm. And all the blame for that lies with Long John Silver. But at the same time, he is so charming and kind that you can see why Jim Hawkins thinks of him as a father figure. And there's so many shades of complexity to this character that really astounded me for how short the book is and how short the film is.
To me, he sort of embodies what in the modern parlance we might call sort of like a sociopath character. You know, someone who is incredibly charming and incredibly convincing, but sort of has no baseline morality and very little ability to connect one-to-one with other people, except for a few that they have designated as special or have kinship to him in some way, which is kind of what happens with the character of Jim. He latches onto him as this figure that is sort of cut from the same cloth as him, basically. And I do think the characterization of Silver in this probably comes the closest to that idea, which I picked up from the book. He is always laughing in this adaptation, and it causes people to laugh along with him. Even sort of the sensible doctor laughs along with him. But it's almost like there's a beat of silence between the laughter. Like, he laughs so exuberantly, and at the start, people are kind of laughing with him almost nervously, like they don't understand what's happening. But then, sort of psychologically, they get absorbed into this, you know, act of laughter, and they sort of begin to feel kinship with him. I think he's slightly unhinged in his affect, but it's in this very jolly way.
I want to touch on something that we haven't really mentioned yet, which is the image of disability in this. It's a really big and complicated thing, but Robert Louis Stevenson's depiction of Long John Silver as having one leg is seen as a lot of the origin point of the kind of one-legged pirate. It's worth pointing out that Long John Silver uses a crutch. He does not have a peg leg, and he's specifically described as having lost his leg near the hip. He's usually represented as having lost it closer to the knee because it's easier to fake that in a film. It's interesting to me that this is a kind of origin point for that kind of reference, because the way that Stevenson uses this feels very different and feels very complicated. I was trying to read about this and I found a chapter called Pirates and Prosthetics: Manly Messages for Managing Limb Loss in Victorian and Edwardian Adventure Narratives. It was actually had a few really interesting points in it about how the use of disability in this case becomes a way of like defining the character. It's a sort of very easy thing to cling onto. And there's a quote from this article which says that equates bodily loss with moral decrepitude, but it also complicates this disability studies model by suggesting that the disabled pirates depicted in late Victorian and Edwardian adventure stories display an alluring form of hypermasculinity that enables them to continue pirating in spite of their physical impairments. Silver is physically incredibly strong. He is like hauling himself all over the ship. He is so active. And it's really interesting to have this signification of a sort of person whose body is seen as broken by his contemporaries that he kind of aggressively compensates for with this very strong masculinity. Stevenson drew inspiration from a friend of his called William Henley, who had lost a leg and was apparently like the total opposite of this character and was just like the nicest guy ever. But he was really impressed by his sort of physical prowess and the way that that seemed to contradict with his disability. I find it really interesting and really, really complicated because at the same time, it's this sort of subversion of expectation, you know, that this man is incredibly strong and incredibly powerful, but it's also a very quick and easy shorthand that is often read as signifying a kind of moral degradation as well.
And it is not just Silver that this is done with. It's done with the character of Black Dog, who has a huge scar across his face. And of course, the very famous blind Pew, who has been blinded, had his eyes put out in the course of his piratical doings. And the thing that I find really interesting about the character of Pew specifically is that when you contrast him with other depictions of blindness from this time period, blindness is often sort of associated with virtuousness and being an object of pity and moving towards a more pure form of life, almost like this sort of like abnegation of the sighted world gives you like this moral character. But Blind Pew was always the character that stuck with me as a child reading Treasure Island, for example, because he is so incredibly threatening. And again, as you say, Alice, he has this strong display of strength. He threatens to break Jim's arm. And despite the fact that he uses a stick and he is feeling his way with his hands, he always seems to make it to the heart of the matter and touch on, you know, the person that he is seeking, the threat that he is making. To me as well, I think another kind of stroke in the box for sort of how retired men of the sea were perceived. They've kind of let an aspect of their life go because they've been forced to by physical circumstance. And it sets up this like really interesting bind in the characters, which the film, I think, doesn't have time to go into, at least with Pew, but does with Silver.
So Silver, he climbs a ladder at one point, like just hopping up it on one leg. Like, he's incredibly strong and able to do, like, his disability doesn't seem to hinder him in any way, except for at one point where he's fallen over and he's asking his adversaries, is it Captain Smollett and the doctor, to help him up, and they refuse.
Yeah.
And so it's, he has this disability only when it serves a plot purpose and to show how unhappy they are with this guy.
And it's interesting because that scene in the film is also kind of a moment of sympathy for him, right? Is that he has said he will sit down with them to negotiate on condition that they help him stand up afterwards, and they refuse to. And it's a moment of sort of like very complicated like dignity and humiliation for him that he does stand up and he does walk away. But it makes Smollett and Trelawney and even Jim look really bad.
Yes. You feel so much sympathy for Long John Silver in that moment because he has really like been hard done by.
The way that scene is framed in the cinematography, it's really sort of like interesting to support this idea because you have the three able-bodied men literally standing over Silver and looking down at him. It's like this very interesting interplay of authority, I think, because Silver has, in many senses, seized back control in that point in the narrative, and he is coming in with his flag of peace to try and broker a truce that will benefit him, for plot reasons, benefit his band of brigands, we don't need to get into it, but they've come to parley, and he, as you say, has made himself vulnerable in that sense, and it really makes the so-called goodies look very bad and very traditionally authoritative, looking down on a disabled man in that way.
Yeah, I actually got that impression from the book too, which I had sort of expected that the book would be a little bit more gung-ho for Smollett and Trelawney and Livesey. And that moment in the book was also really heartbreaking, where he does say like, well, I will sit if you help me up, and then they don't. And it contrasts too with Jim a little bit later, who has given his word to stay with Long John Silver, again, for complicated plot reasons. And the doctor's like, no, I can get you out of here. Just run away with me. And Jim's like, no, 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 I gave my word. I gave my word. I'm staying. And he does. But it's sort of like there's a weird moral difference between Jim and the three grown men that he is supposed to be on the side with and looking up to, and that Jim keeps his word even when it doesn't necessarily benefit him, whereas the three grown men don't keep their word. And I think there was something about Jim being like Long John. And I thought that that was an interesting point, particularly in that Jim is always doing things to try to help out the quote unquote good guys and to advance the cause of the original crew and not the mutineers. But he keeps doing things that are ultimately bad. Like he sneaks off to shore when he's not supposed to, and that works out in their favor because he finds Ben Gunn. And then he sneaks away from their camp in the middle of the night, and it works out in his favor through sheer luck that he's managed to overpower Isaac Hands and take the Hispaniola back. So he keeps doing these things that help them, but it is against orders in a very Long John-like way. So I think that Jim's morality is also a little bit gray, in the way that Long John Silver's is a little bit gray, whereas we're supposed to just think that Smollett is like the most upstanding, best guy in the whole world. And that moment where he doesn't help Long John up kind of, even in the book, you feel like it undercuts Smollett's decency.
I think it's really interesting to think about it in the context of Treasure Island, the original novel, already being a historical fiction. Mm-hmm. You know, it's 19th century does 18th century, right? And so I think, like, from what you're saying there, like, you can kind of see a subtle difference between those two ideologies, between a sort of very Victorian value of an individualistic single figure making independent decisions, and from those independent decisions going off to make his way in the world, versus this kind of 18th century value within the so-called morally good naval seafaring life of, you know, discipline, order, maintaining the status quo, deferring to your captain. And thinking about this idea, which we will also touch on in later episodes on the various Treasure Island adaptations, the idea that Jim, on the cusp of puberty, is beginning to think about what masculinity means to him. His own father having just died, he's entering this profoundly masculine world. And as you said, Alice, there's like literally not a single credited woman in this film whatsoever. And in the book, I think there's just Jim's mother, and that's about it. So it is like all about Jim taking from all these different models to figure out who does he want to be. And that, to me, like, that's a very Victorian boy's own narrative. How are you going to become a man?
Completely. Can we talk about Ben Gunn?
Little xylophone man himself.
Oh my god. Okay, Ben Gunn is another member of Flint's original crew. He had been marooned on the island by Flint with the treasure. He's one of the people that's involved in burying it. And for reasons unknown, instead of killing him like he does with everyone else, Flint just leaves him on the island. Ben Gunn is honestly just the weirdest little guy. He turns out he has dug up the treasure and re-hidden it so that the map is useless in the end. The map doesn't actually direct you to the treasure, which is a plot point, obviously. But he's just been hanging out on this island, going steadily weirder and dreaming of cheese.
When I was watching the film, I was sort of like giving them kudos, because you think that the cheese thing is exaggerated, but if anything, in the novel, he talks about cheese even more than this. And Dr. Livesey enables his cheese love as well, because for some reason he has a chunk of Parmesan in a snuff box, and he sort of holds it over Ben Gunn's head, like, if you do what I say, you can have my chunk of Parmesan that I inexplicably keep upon my person.
Look, these are two behaviours that are incredibly relatable.
So in this, Ben Gunn is accompanied by a jaunty little xylophone trill every time he does anything. And it's funny because he becomes such a, like, comedy character, and there is something kind of sad and troubling about it. Mm. I obviously went straight to the, like, cultural history of castaways, and particularly the way that that kind of occupies a place in colonial imagination. We have the stories of the sort of Robinson Crusoes of it all, but there are also so many stories of people being shipwrecked or cast ashore or lost at sea or whatever. And the kind of question of like, how do you maintain your civilization on the edge of the world is a really, really big thing in the late 18th, early 19th century. So from about 1750 to about 1830 or 40, one of the kind of best-selling genres is castaway or kind of life amongst the quote-unquote savages, and the question of like, how do you maintain your Englishness? The classic thing that people always do to prove that they are in fact a good Christian is that they will like recite the Lord's Prayer, or they will introduce themselves as a Christian when they finally meet Europeans again. I thought it was really interesting that one of the first things Ben Gunn says in this is that he's not had any Christian food for a very long time. He's referring to cheese. He's talking about all the goats and berries that he's been eating. But the phrasing of Christian there is really striking. There's a tiny little bit of religion in this. The black spot is drawn on a page from the Bible, and that's seen as like a very ill omen and things like that. But the kind of paralleling and euphemism of Christian to mean sort of civilized European is something that stood out for me in that little Ben Gunn interlude.
I don't think that any Treasure Island adaptation that I have seen gets Ben Gunn right. I think because every adaptation that I've seen treats Ben Gunn as, to some degree, a comic relief character, someone who is unserious in contrast to the serious pirates who are the real threat. And it's sort of implied that as a Maroonee, Ben Gunn has sort of, you know, defaulted on his masculinity. He allowed himself to be like put in that situation, and his ability to express himself, communicate with others has declined, and this is like a sort of marker of comedy. In the novel, Ben Gunn is much more morally grey and ambiguous. There's something threatening and strange, and there's a fear that he's going to play both sides because he is the go-between. No one remembers that he's on the island, so he can move as he wishes and move between the camps. There's this really characteristic and revealing scene where he creeps his way onto the outskirts of the pirate camp and mimics the voice of Captain Flint to make the pirates think that he is Flint's ghost, and like heighten their superstition to sort of like throw them off the game and make them more easy to overthrow. And that's like, it's like a little pinch of the gothic being added into this adventuresome novel. And that's something that I've never seen adapted. They don't put it into this film. And I think it's such a shame that they just make him a quirky xylophone character, because I think there is so much depth there. The other thing that I wanted to say about Ben Gunn, which again doesn't make it into this film for some reason, is he again like brings up this really interesting question of like moral recidivism at the end of the narrative, because he is rescued, he is brought off the island and rewarded with a portion of the treasure. None of this really happens in the film. His reward is basically getting cheese. But it says at the end of the novel that Ben Gunn had spent his portion of the treasure within a year and was found weeping and begging on the streets. And I think like that idea of people reverting to type and people who have been traumatized by their seafaring experiences reverting to this pattern of behavior again and again is something that Stevenson treats with surprising moral sensitivity. And in the novel, like, to me, it's such a perfect, if tragic, end to Ben Gunn's story that he sort of falls prey to his own greed and falls back into that sort of pattern of moral abandonment. You lose all that in the adaptations, and I think it's just a real shame.
Do you think he spent the whole fortune on cheese?
I was about to say that. Got 3 years worth of cheese to catch up on. Give the man a break.
Cheese is expensive.
Yeah, it's fucking, that shit costs a lot of money.
Yeah, especially Parmesan.
Let's talk about exploring a little bit. Sarah, you had some thoughts on navigation.
I mean, far too many thoughts. But for this being a film where they travel across the world, they don't talk about it an awful lot. But there are two mentions of it. And one is when they look at the map. The first one, they go longitude, latitude, X marks the spot. Now, real latitude heads will know that that's not actually what you see on the map, and also that was not a thing that was marked on maps at this point. The other time is when Long John Silver says to his comrades, "We can sail a course, but we can't calculate it ourselves, so we need Captain Smollett and company to do this for us." So I went to look, because this is slightly later than my period, but I'm like, this, I don't think this is right, and it isn't. In like the early 18th century, in about 707, there was a bunch of really severe accidents because people had not calculated longitude correctly, and these ships kept running ashore. So in 1714, the British government set up the Commissioners for the Discovery of Longitude at Sea, or Board of Longitude for short, where they set up a reward for the scientist or whoever could figure out a way of calculating longitude at sea. So the problem is that if you're just sailing, you can figure out where your latitude is fairly easily, but longitude is a lot more difficult. And they rewarded up to £20,000 for the person who could figure this out. They never actually gave out the full amount of money to anyone, but John Harrison was developed a chronometer over several years, and he was given £500 a bunch of different times, which... A chronometer is like a fancy word for a clock. And if you have a chronometer that, or a clock that measures the time where you set off, and then you know what the local time is where you are by measuring the angle of the sun, then you can figure out where you are, what your longitude is. The problem is that to develop a clock that will keep time accurately for the entire time that you're away. And that didn't happen for quite a long time. So this film is really firmly set. Like, they've told us what the date is. And none of these methods were really developed by then. Chronometers become common by 1850. And in 1870 and 1890s, we have lunar tables that are used. So there are ways of measuring longitude at this point that are sort of in development and people are using them. But the Board of Longitude is abolished in 1828. And this book is written, 50 years after that? And then this film is made another 80 years after that. So it's just interesting to me how the distance, the temporal distance between these kind of changes means that the material culture and the expressions about how you calculate these kinds of things is completely lost when this film is made. They just mention it, but there are no signs of people actually doing any of these calculations. If you were to go back and look at this film again and freeze frame it every time they're inside of the captain's cabin, you'll see two astronomical tools that are used. I know, because I did this. And then if you zoom in, you'll figure out that one of them is an equinoctial ring dial. I've put this in the notes. I might post it on Twitter as well for those that want to see. And it's, the problem with this one is that it's far larger than the equinoctial. It's a type of a portable sundial that you take with you that you can measure the distance, the angle of the sun. And it's far larger than they usually were. And it's just kind of as a decoration in the background. And then there's also, it's not, it looks kind of like a grandfather clock, but it's not that. The things that you would be expecting to see at a ship at this time are things like sextants and maybe astrolabes, or there would be ways for people to measure where they are. For me, it's just very interesting to see the difference in how, like, this kind of material is forgotten. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, by the time Stevenson wrote this book, timekeeping was accurate enough at this point that you could establish what longitude was. And in, I think it's 1850, the prime meridian is established through Greenwich. Mm-hmm. And then it's only 30 years later that almost something like 2/3 of maps use that as their guideline. It really takes over how people thought about it. And it's understandable that that would be the case for Stevenson as well.
It's so interesting to kind of think of it as the reverse of sci-fi babble. In science fiction, there's this thing where you kind of like make up a random thing to explain how characters get from A to B. But this is historical, so it's like the opposite of that. And they just like yada, 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 the very intricate and involved processes of navigation which were involved.
Yeah, but I mean, there's only so much drama you can get out of someone like holding a nocturne up to like align it with particular stars.
I would also say like a lot of the kind of colonial era literature that I've read, like things that are either contemporary or set in that period, the use of a chronometer can become a really important plot device because it needs to be so meticulously maintained. You have to wind it right, you've got to treat it right, you've got to make sure that it's in the right humidity, things like that. You know, they can get thrown out of whack so easily. You're on a fucking boat and there are so many things that can go wrong to mess with this very delicate mechanism. And so a device that you'll often see is that the chronometer's out of whack and suddenly you're lost at sea. And that can be really effective. Someone might deliberately tamper with it to get them lost as an act of sabotage. And so there is this way that you can use that kind of material culture as navigation. Obviously, it's not the priority here. We're just trying to get to the damn island. But yeah, it is exactly the kind of parallel opposite of the sci-fi, like, it's a wormhole, jumpy, loopy thing.
And given that it's such a theme in the Treasure Island story of sort of like intense discipline and personal responsibility versus debauched piratical antics, it could have been really interesting to kind of see, like, you know, you want to be captain, but you're none of your crew are doing the things required to take you from A to B.
I mean, yeah, it would also be another marker of how much smarter Smollett is than everyone else, because he's the only one who can use your lunar tables to figure out where you are.
Right, exactly, yeah.
But I just want to add one last detail, which is that the black spot is invented by Stevenson for Treasure Island, and it's become such a motif now. The idea that you, as a pirate, might receive a mark on a piece of paper, like that there will be some kind of pirate conference. Pirates are really into democracy. And that if you are given the black spot, it is a marker of either demotion or kind of like the consensus is against you. Sometimes it's used to signify death in Treasure Island. It's literally invented for this. It makes me think of the kind of like practice of blackballing people out of members clubs in the 18th century. If you had too many debts or whatever, you'd be blackballed and you wouldn't be allowed in anymore. But it's interesting as a kind of imitation of that like gentlemanly behavior that is very much informed by democracy and negotiation. All of the pirate conferences in this are treated as kind of faintly ridiculous. It fits to me within a history of union busting, to be quite honest, and like putting it in the context of Disney at the time and how pissed off he is at all his workers, it makes a lot of sense to have this kind of image of like mutiny and crew discontent treated as something faintly ridiculous.
But the
kind of concept of the black spot as this kind of cultural connotation originates with Stevenson in Treasure Island, and it's another one of these motifs that we see: the missing leg, the parrot, the, you know, the kind of tropes that now really define pirate literature originates here.
And the black spot doesn't automatically mean death. It has become like bastardized into like the black spot is a marker of death. So yeah, thank you so much for bringing that up, because yeah, first of all, not a real quote-unquote piratical thing, second of all, already bastardized from its original fictional context. There's so much more space for a parliamentary procedure in the black spot.
I'd also like to sort of close with talking about the aesthetic of the film as a whole and how this, I think, informs what Disney ends up doing in the theme parks, Disneyland and Disney World, and now across the world with his Pirates of the Caribbean ride, and how if you look at these sets and if you look at the way these pirates look and the way they talk, it's very much baked into the 1967 ride, which is the last theme park attraction that Disney himself worked on prior to his death. So I think that this is interesting as sort of like a seed for him of how he exports his vision of Caribbean pirates to the world through the 1960s, 70s, 80s, and into today.
So interesting.
We're going to wrap up here.
Sure.
This is the first in three Treasure Island episodes that we're going to be doing. And we'll keep talking about the different ways that this story's been interpreted. But yeah, thanks for joining us.